Oh, yeah, we're all set.
Okay, we're going to wrap up today, and so what I would like to do is give you kind of an overview of where we've gone on the course and how I like teaching this course a lot because it helps me clarify my own thinking about the contemporary period, and there is nothing that is harder to get a handle on than the moment that you yourself are living through. Actually, there's a philosopher by the name of Ernst Bloch, a German philosopher, who refers to this as the darkness of the lived moments. The darkness of the lived moment. It's as though we can see everything except our own perspective on events at the very moment at which they are occurring. It's sort of like you can see everything except your own eyes, right? Yeah. I'm talking about, I don't think it matters whether there's mass media or there's not. I think this is this is built into the human condition. Because let's face it, you know, the complexity of events is overwhelming, and it always has been. You know, there are natural forces that condition human affairs. I mean, you know, who knows whether or not a new ice age will start in a couple of weeks, right? You know, it's possible. It's possible that there'll be a meteor that hits the planet and changes the conditions of people's lives. I don't expect anything like that to wipe out human life, but it would alter very radically the conditions of human life. So we can't even anticipate natural events. And then when you enter into the equation human affairs, where you have literally billions of people all making their own decisions and acting in certain ways, of course, their actions are structured by institutions, but still, you know, it's they themselves who act. And so that the moment that we live through is really the outcome of that astonishing number of forces. You know, once you get distance on it, once you're 100 years ahead, you can look back and say, oh, that's what was happening. But it's difficult to grasp exactly what forces are bearing on you in the current moment, especially when you take a look at the broad scale. And we live on the broad scale now, and there's no doubt about it. We are global citizens. Whether you like cosmopolitanism or not, we are cosmopolitans. You know, this is one reason why I think the Stoics are a very, very important source for understanding the current period, because they're the first ones who really see that the direction of history is headed toward cosmopolitanism. Yeah, the species just is not going to continue in small groups, separated from one another. And yeah, the Stoics were in a position to see this because they lived in an expansive empire where the boundaries between small groups were being broken down through force of arms. But now, I mean, it's just astonishing the degree to which our lives are globalized. You pick up the newspaper and you know, the international coverage all of a sudden becomes much more extensive. You know, it has to. You know, what's happening in Greece right now, it bears on what's going to happen in the United States. What's happening in China right now bears on what's going to happen in the United States. And people are beginning to take all this stuff seriously. Yeah. Possible. It's possible, but I doubt that we're ever going to get to the point of colonizing the moon unless the globe reaches a level of political unity that we don't currently have. And first of all, that process would require such an enormous number of resources. I think it would outstrip the ability of any nation to do that. And secondly, it would require the coordination of technological forces across national boundaries, which is already happening. I mean, technology is international. Science is international, right? I mean, scientists are constantly reading research papers written by, you know, people in Nigeria or people in China or whatnot. Their frame of reference is global. The economic frame of reference, the frame of reference of corporations is global. You know, the idea that we just have to protect American corporations and everything will be okay in the United States is absurd, because American corporations have many, many operations around the world. So as they flourish, often what they do is, of course, employ labor elsewhere. You know, they have subsidiaries all over, including in China. The U.S. has a number of subsidiaries in China actually employing people. Some of the Chinese export into the United States is actually made by American corporations, by the way. I mean, not an insignificant amount of it. And so this is all going to continue. And of course, the hot button issue, I think, for Europe and for the United States over the next period, besides the economy, is going to continue to be mass immigration, which, as far as I can see, no government will be able to stop. And you can build as many walls as you want separating the New Mexico from the United States, but as long as people can do better in the U.S. than they can in Mexico, they're going to come. Yeah?
Well, the problem with immigration is that people inside it, that even actual security, just people letting people through, you know? Let's see. What do they call them, coyotes?
What?
People that transport...
Oh, the coyotes.
Yeah, coyotes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, they'll probably say, oh, Bruce's when he's sort of terrorizing you, you know? And they'll let you...
Yeah, well, I mean, if there's money in it, of course, an industry arises around it, whether it's legal or not, right? That's the nature of capitalism, whether it's, you know, the law is secondary. So, you know, you'll have people transporting other people across the borders, and they'll become professional at it, and they'll figure out how to circumvent whatever barriers are in place and so on, yeah.
At the same time, though, I think that illegal immigration is essentially a functional aspect of capitalism.
Yes, absolutely.
Capitalism requires a large pool of unemployed laborers because it makes all the competent people work harder to do well.
Yeah, and it puts downward pressure on wage rates.
They find it useful to like try and disqualify as many people as possible. And illegal immigrants form, you know, a viciously competitive labor market and drive down the entire wage rate, because corporations don't have to pay them as well, and they're desperate for the jobs.
Yes, that's right. And there's a tremendous pressure on the part of corporations to bring in not necessarily illegals, but aliens on work visas.
Of course, you know, Mitt Romney, for example, who, you know, was of course rapidly anti-immigration. He's probably going to try and ride that to success in some future election, I'm sure.
Yeah, probably the next one, actually.
He had illegal immigrants working in his garden and as servants at his house. It's like you really have to ask, why do these people want these policies? Is it really because they're protecting our jobs? Or do they want to make us work harder for less?
Yeah. And you see, also, the other thing, of course, is that sort of like the way that Foucault says that prisons actually ended up serving a function that was compatible with the whole power structure. Remember, prisons fail at their goal of reforming criminals, right? Rehabilitation is not one of the glaring high points of prisons. But what they succeed at is in creating a caste of professional criminals, which justifies outlays on police departments and justifies the spread of surveillance beyond prisons to the rest of the society. And by the same token, so-called illegals ratchet up the security apparatus too. So what you get is, you know, people get serious about tracking down illegals, what that means is a tremendous investment in police forces and immigration and naturalization forces. And ultimately, it means subjecting everybody to questioning. The bill in Arizona that just passed, are people aware of this? Arizona passed a bill that allows police to stop people in Arizona and ask them about their citizenship status. You know? Including you when you go to Arizona, right? Yeah.
They were already doing that before the law was put in place.
I don't doubt it.
So
I do not doubt it, yeah. Yeah, you know my feeling. New York and Boston and San Francisco and the rest of the U.S. can go to hell. Well, I wouldn't say that. I kind of like Seattle, too.
Everybody's illegal because what you call somebody undocumented person, nobody's illegal, you know? It's just somebody crossing the border, but they're not really illegal.
Right, right. You mean people who are undocumented? Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm talking about like somebody from Mexico.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, nobody's illegal, you know?
Yeah.
Because nobody's alien. Like, when you're talking about alien, uh-huh. Somebody came from space, you know?
Well, what you're recommending is that we drop the word illegal, right? Yeah, people are not themselves illegal. That's true.
Well, I mean, people have tried to take that to extremes, though.
Yeah.
Maybe it was 10 years ago now, there was an effort to criminalize being an undocumented immigrant and make it like a felony.
Yeah. That would have been a real solution, right? You don't want social resources going to undocumented aliens, so you put them in prison and spend far more money on them than the society would have spent had they left them alone.
At the same time, yeah. By criminalizing them, I think you would quickly find that they would become.
Sure. Well, these are all specific questions having to do with the ethics of quote unquote illegal immigration. But however you fall out on this issue, my only point is that it ain't going away. And it's probably going to expand. You know, and certainly not just the United States. All of Europe is faced with the same difficulties of immigration, not from Mexico so much, but from Turkey and from the North African countries,
Nigeria
as well. Yeah, absolutely. So it's a major issue that's tied up with the breakdown of, I would call it now, you could call it the breakdown of localism, but what it really is the breakdown of the nation state as the central political actor. I think that's really what's going on here. If nation states can't control their borders in the sense of, you know, cannot prevent massive numbers of people from coming in without papers, and if they cannot stop capital flows from moving across national borders so that their companies begin hiring people in foreign subsidiary operations. And if they can't protect themselves from financial meltdowns in Greece or in China or whatnot, then you're really talking about a period in which the problems that the world faces outstrips the ability of nation states to handle. Now, that doesn't mean that nation states are going to collapse. You know, I think that would be an absurd idea. You're going to have nation states for quite some time. But the question is, and I think if you take a look at what's going to be happening, they're not going to be sufficient. And already, you know, the people who sort of are powerful in the world have begun to recognize this and have begun to establish various ways of pulling together across national boundaries. But of course, and this is where a lot of conspiracy theory comes in, right? The conspiracy theory. But they're not conspirators. I mean, they tell you what they're doing. You know, we know what they're doing. They're up to no good. You know, and we know that. And all you got to do is read the records of their meetings, and you know they're up to no good. You know, basically what they're trying to do is create situations where interests that they're connected with can prevail. And, you know, it's and there's no doubt about that. But still, like I said, it's not hidden. It's if you just read a little bit, you know, it's right there. Yeah, you're going to say something?
Oh, and it was just on the immigration thing earlier. I think part of the problem is that the government only wants a certain amount of people that can benefit the economy. So you have a lot of people being left behind that have little to low skills, or they might have skills, but they don't know the language, so it's harder. For example, I know that Mexico has a large amount of somewhat good education system, but they don't have jobs provide to match that education.
Yeah, that's true.
So you have a outstripping of how many people in the United States actually want versus how many people actually want to come in and contribute. So I guess part of the argument that seems a little bit unfair is about people that have that are able to go through all those loops and come in versus people that might deserve to come in, but the U.S. doesn't want it. For example, might be running out of sheep herders. So they'll all sheep herders from the countries, if you know how to herd sheep, then come on in, we want you. And you just might walk out that year, but you might have to still.
But you know, it really doesn't work that way. It's not as though immigration is keyed to the need for various kinds of labor. I mean, for example, if you look at, I think they were called H-1 visas. H-1 visas, are they? I think they are called H-1 visas. They're visas that are given mostly to South Asians, to Indians and Pakistanis, mostly Indians, but to come in and do software work, you know, programming, all kinds of stuff, right? Well, you know, it's easy to, if you do that, you don't have to pay benefits, you don't have to pay, you know, into health, you know, retirement, and you can also start them off at entry-level wages and then move them on by the time they would get a raise normally, that sort of thing. So it's much cheaper for companies to do that. Now, if you take a look at the so-called high-tech crisis, where this was before the collapse, right, when people were being told that they needed to gear up, you know, the colleges and churn out more computer specialists. And if you look at the current period where there are, you know, there's a crisis, you know, there isn't enough work for high-tech people to go around. What you see is that under both conditions, the industry, the computer industry, lobbies the state, lobbies the government for more H-1 visas. In other words, it doesn't matter whether we need software workers or don't need software workers. Companies need them to drive down wage rates. And they tend to, you know, their voices tend to prevail in shaping immigration policy. So, once again, you know, I think you have to be careful. It's not as though there's a national purpose that's being met by U.S. immigration policy. The purposes are really much more specific. And they have to do with the lobbying by industries, you know, for additional workers. There is a problem, though, with immigration in the U.S., and that is one of the big problems that people don't want to focus on is that immigrant workers are competition for the lowest paid workers in the U.S., who tend still to be black. And so what you get is a situation where, for example, in Chicago, I remember I used to do labor work, and I was in a national group called the National Alliance for Fair Employment, and I met some organizers, some Latino organizers from Chicago. And what was happening in Chicago is that Latinos and African Americans were lining up on street corners for what's sometimes called shape up. This is day labor, right? For day labor, you go to a street corner, a guy comes by with a truck and says, you, 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 and you, get on, right? Okay. But what was happening was the trucks were picking up Latinos and not picking up African Americans. And the reason why was that the assumption was that the Latinos were illegals, which meant that they were much more docile to handle, right? You know, obviously, right?
They didn't have to worry about.
Yeah, they didn't have to worry about, you know, for example, and this happens throughout the day labor industry, sometimes they don't get paid.
Yeah, if they're illegal,
they can't say anything, right? Sometimes they do not get paid. They just don't get paid. And the company says, well, go to the cops if you want to. But of course they don't. So there was a problem, but the result was tension between Latinos and African Americans in Chicago. But what these guys did, well, I thought it was, you know, a brilliant thing, really wonderful idea, was that they began organizing across race lines. And they came up with the Chicago Day Labor Project, which said, look, what we want is equity for everybody involved. We want an end to discrimination. We also want protection for the people, the Latinos who are being hired, and so forth and so on. And so they came up with a kind of common agenda, which they pushed, and they were very successful in doing it. So it's not impossible to get beyond this stuff. But I'll tell you, having organized, I got to tell you, that to get anything, you know, it's amazing. You know, to get health benefits that are due to you, you know, it's like you have to be able to put in a lot of time. And you have to be in it for the long haul, which is something that I think, you know, is a skill that a lot of people don't have. We're impatient. So organizing sometimes takes years to pay off. But there's no doubt that it pays off if you have enough people And if you've got people who are shrewd about strategy and stuff like that, all kinds of stuff can happen. Yes?
When I was in high school, I used to do that. I had my traveling job, but I had a thing where there'll be a vendor, you know, come and pick us up, take us to this factory where we have to put like CDs together and dealership them overseas.
Right. And was this in Haiti or the U.S.?
No, in the U.S.
In the U.S. Yeah, yeah.
So I had to wait 2 weeks to get paid, which is, I didn't mind because I had my job.
Yeah.
I was in high school, you know, like just extra money.
So you were able to wait that long, but a lot of these guys are just, they're living hand to mouth, right?
Also like the condition of the people, like you find young and old.
Oh, yeah. Often, I remember talking to one guy who did day labor. He would get picked up in the morning and brought to a factory where he had to operate a machine that was dangerous. And, you know, there are situations where people had their hands cut off as a result of not being trained to operate the machine. Well, you know, there's no health insurance, right? The company's not responsible for the health insurance. Yeah. In Boston, actually, there's been some work on all this stuff. It was a Boston guy I was talking to. There's a Brazilians in particular are heavily invested in day labor. I mean, they do a lot of day labor. And there's a Brazilian worker center in Boston that tries to organize around day labor issues. One of the things that these centers have been able to do is they've been able to go up the food chain. Because what happens is a lot of times these day labor companies will, sometimes it's an immigrant who actually does this, right? A day laborer who decides that he doesn't want to actually do the hands-on work anymore, so he's going to contract. And so he subcontracts, I guess subcontract is the word, he subcontracts with the company that wants the day laborers. He supplies the workers. But a lot of these guys are fly-by-night, right? So by the time it's time to get paid, they're gone. And the company would disavow any responsibility. You know, it wasn't us, it was the subcontractor who was responsible. Well, lawyers, one lawyer in New York in particular, worked on this issue for years, and she finally got the courts to accept the principle of moving up the food chain. So now it's the companies that they work for that are responsible for paying them, and they can't flee.
So contractors going out of the picture now, or what's wrong with that?
Well, I suppose that they're being subject to stricter controls by the companies that use them. Well, I mean, the point is that it means, it's anything else, it's like specialization, right? Instead of the company having to get a truck and bring it around on street corners and select people who are reliable or whatnot, you get somebody else to do it and you pay them, right? They figure it's cheaper in the long run to do that rather than to run the operation yourself, that kind of thing, yeah.
Are the people that stay on the corners, are they illegal immigrants?
No, there's a mix. There's a mix of people, but day labor is a magnet for people without without legal immigration status.
So then how and why are people trying to get
unprotected? How and why?
Yeah.
Well, the idea is this. How is kind of the things I was telling you about,
yeah.
Right? But why, I think that the idea is that, how can I put it? It's like whatever your feelings are about crossing the border, once people have crossed, they're here. And if you don't, and if you're in the labor movement in particular, if you don't fight for them, what ends up happening is Americans get screwed. So if you fight for them, if you increase their wages, you know, if you increase their benefit rates and stuff like that, that puts a floor under the wages of everybody else. Whereas if they're left super exploited, then people who are unskilled, basically, unskilled workers, although illegals are not just in the unskilled sectors of the economy, you know, but unskilled workers, their wage rates and so forth are undercut. So the idea is that it really doesn't make any sense to turn on them. Turning on them just screws yourself. Yeah.
What pays off more for the state, though, like to make them legal and just get
their taxes, like they get the rest of our taxes, or is it more profitable to just keep them at the status that they are and exploit them in other ways that bring money?
Yeah, well, I suppose it's a question of who's in power when and what the particular sector is and stuff like that. You would think that for the government it would make sense to, you know, get regular taxation from them and so forth. But of course, government also responds to, you know, to lobbyists. Yeah.
I think another thing, the government really requires having issues that produce political polarity. You know, they rely on the majority of people most of the time not bothering to, like, pick up the New York Times and read the press releases or, like, sift through the declassified records or the IPO 4 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and so if they have these kinds of hot-button issues like immigration, you know, they not only get basically slaves, but, you know, they have something else to distract us with. We're too busy fighting each other to bother looking at that.
That's true, although I think that that's more of a motive on the part of employers than necessarily on the part of elected officials. Elected officials differ.
I think that this applies to a lot of things.
Yeah.
At the same time, you know, we were talking about, like, the privatization of prisons last time.
Mm-hmm.
But the amount of money which the government could bring in from a legalized drug industry, I'm sure more than would make up for the cost to the private.
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah. As a matter of fact, this is part of the pressure for medical marijuana, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
That's one of the major things that they've been flashing in front of the government's face is something like $14 billion for ending the war on pot. But, you know, and that's, I think, an estimate of combined tax money and savings on expenditures for incarceration.
Mm-hmm.
I would think it would be a lot more than
that.
But at the same time, the numbers are all really skewed because of self-reporting on who smokes
pot.
Yeah.
I mean, just your buys alone, James, should be about $14
billion.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, they are irrational rules.
It keeps us at each other's throats.
Yeah, I mean, really, when you think about it, when you think about why marijuana is not legal, but liquor is, liquor is more dangerous, far more dangerous than marijuana. Yeah.
Well, it may sound silly, but I think part of it is that if a substance has been in a culture long enough, they start to accept it more than if culture has been introduced later. For example, marijuana is native to India and Southeast Asia.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not something that was in the culture for a long enough period to be ingrained in mindset that...
Whose culture?
Well, I would have to say the native...
Yeah, if you hung out with jazz musicians in the 20s, it was in that culture.
I'm just talking about longer, in this year, for example, alcohol has been associated in human society for a lot longer systematically, but...
You mean in Europe and the United States?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That fails to explain prohibition, though.
That is true. But prohibition also failed.
Yeah. It fails to explain prohibition. It also fails to explain why there was a thriving hemp industry going back to the earliest colonial period here, which was completely criminalized with the prohibition.
I feel like we're at the Freedom Fest.
Yeah, well, we're not at the Freedom Fest. Hemp is just for making rope. It's not something you can...
Yes, I know. Hemp is good. It's the best. It's going to solve all our problems.
I'm not saying it's going to solve all our problems, but before the era of, you know, our current industrial rope fabrics, you know, it was what people made rope from.
Well, you know, I have to say that the movement to legalize marijuana is interesting, because you cannot get young people, you know, to march against the war, to, you know, to do civil rights stuff. Like, for God, but they come out to the Freedom Fest. You know, they come out in droves. You know, my nephew talks about the movement. You know, the movement. I feel like I'm in the 60s. And for him, it's a serious thing, you know, because it's tied up with issues of social control, of police power, of stuff like that. So I wouldn't scoff at it, actually. You know, I think actually it's a significant thing. And it's beginning to have certain certain victories. So there was one state recently that legalized medical marijuana.
Colorado,
yeah. Yeah, my nephew's thinking about moving there, as a matter of fact.
Actually, there's...
we like to, in my family, we like to call him Farmer Bob.
They're going to have a ballot referendum on commercial...
in Massachusetts?
Well,
California?
Oh, California.
Yeah, in Massachusetts, it's going before the legislature. It's almost certain to fail.
Yeah, they're probably too stoned to know what they're reading. This is the other thing. You know, all these legislators who are enforcing anti-pot laws, and they all smoke pot, right? You know, at least when they were younger, anyway. the new prime minister of course, you know, Obama smoked pot, he admitted. And now it's sort of required now for politicians to just say it. Once they say it, they're absolved. Right? There was a time when it would sink you. But now, you know, Obama says it, the new conservative prime minister of England says it, who cares, right? That indicates that there's been movement on the issue, there's no doubt about it. So I expect that that will continue, and that young people who have been involved in that and pushing for that are not to be scoffed at. I mean, that's a successful effort.
At
you know?
The same time, though, it seems like the movement, if you call that, yeah. It seems to stand for social justice somewhat selectively. Frequently, we're more than willing to ignore the gross social inequalities in our society if we think we can get what would...
I'm in favor of subsidized marijuana, for the you know, so that we all social classes can smoke it. See, I'm more radical than you are on the issue, James.
In your generation, there were things like the draft. You know, people had to stand up for
yes.
something because it was stand up for something
yes.
or get shot in some hellhole.
Yes, and I actually am expecting much more activism among the general population, especially the young, because I don't see, I mean, I have to tell you this, and I think you probably already know this, I don't see where jobs are coming from. You know, I just don't see them. I mean, the industry has gone abroad. That's not coming back. You know, that used to employ tons of people at livable wages. It wasn't great working in factories, but you could make, you know, I guess it would be the equivalent now of maybe even, you know, 60,000 if you'd been there for a while. And if you had a married couple working, you know, they could actually sustain a pretty nice middle-class lifestyle. That's gone. I don't see biotech, which is hot, right? Boston's a center of biotech, but that's not employing the kind of people that automobiles, you know, or steel employed. High tech's still around, of course, but a lot of that has been offshored. You know, there's this notion that if you just educate Americans, you just increase their knowledge and their skills, that new industries will come. You know, there are plenty of educated, knowledgeable, skilled people all around the world willing to work for a lot less. So it seems to me that we're dealing with a long-term job crisis that's really going to affect people's life chances, you know, unless they come up with some solutions themselves. Yeah.
Thomas Friedman talks about that sort of thing where it's the overeducated white-collar underemployment
mm-hmm.
and how we actually need to start moving towards like innovation instead of actually just trying to find jobs. Like we need to, instead of focusing on like just educating people for the jobs that we already have,
right.
We need to start educating people on how to create new jobs.
Yeah, but I don't get what that means. I know a lot of people say that. That entrepreneurship, innovation, but see the problem is that the entrepreneurship and the innovation is mostly in electronics or in biotech, and those industries just don't absorb a lot of workers.
Well, I mean, in the old economy, the pre-industrial economy, any household with a loom and some sheep had its own means of production.
Yeah, right.
Nowadays, you know, you can't. For a long time, people couldn't really make anything. I think the question is now that we have all these new technologies, all these new means of production, can people who previously would have constituted the unemployed part of the workforce driving the competition actually create their own means of production?
Well, it's possible. It's possible now, especially I don't think that computers can substitute for, you know, growing food and making objects, manufacturing objects, but they can facilitate it. And they can facilitate it for people who want to organize local networks.
Yeah.
You know, there are all kinds of things. Like, for example, there are some people who have developed local currencies. So, you know, you print your own currency and you use that within, it's not government tender, but it's accepted by people within a community, and you're able to do that and facilitate interaction between members of the local community rather than buying it, you know, from suppliers in, I don't know, North Korea or South Korea or something like that. You know. There are possibilities out there. There's no doubt about it. Yeah?
Well, I think all these issues boil down to how it affects people personally. A lot of these issues like civil rights and the war, although they're issues, a lot of people, they don't affect them personally anymore. So you'll have issues that affect the people, like a social recreation activity like marijuana, that people take issue with because it's affecting their fun and their entertainment. So as long as you're not taking away things that can keep people occupied or that will harm them in some way, people generally try to stay away.
Yeah, I think that's true. But of course, the whole problem is this, right? We're living in a time that's volatile. You know, I don't think that we have rulers, certainly, you know, political rulers and economic rulers, but I don't think they understand what's going on. I think they're as confused as anybody. You know, they sort of cobble together policy from crisis to crisis.
Whoa.
And no, shh. I've got 10 minutes left, and I'm taking it. They cobble together policy from crisis to crisis, and, you know, and they wait for the next one to come up. And so, but what that means is, as there's a social theorist by the name of Emmanuel Wallerstein, that means that the system has entered into a period of, in chaos theory, I don't really totally buy chaos theory, but in chaos theory, it's called bifurcation. What it means is that normally systems are in equilibrium, they oscillate around equilibrium, but there are factors, and sometimes they're unanticipated factors, that can make the system go like this, right? And when it goes like this, it has to settle into a new state. And the possible new states are along lines of what are called bifurcation. So when things become crisis-ridden, they also become chaotic in the chaos theory sense. And what that means, according to Wallerstein, is that they are susceptible to action by relatively small numbers of people. In other words, when something is out of equilibrium, you can tip it in one direction or another.
You're talking about like World War I, on how fascism took over Europe?
Well, I suppose that could be an example, but for Wallerstein, the bifurcation and the crisis, according to him, is in the system that we've been living in for 500 years. Namely, it's a crisis. It's a kind of terminal crisis of capitalism. The issue is what follows it, according to Wallerstein. Something better could follow it. Something worse could follow it. You know, it depends upon who gets their act together and who is able to concertedly push in the right direction. And so I know things seem like there's no possibility of change, and especially in America, we have this kind of, but all over the world, you know, not just America, Europe too, we have this kind of, you know, depressive feeling of what can be done. But according to Wallerstein, in this period, quite a bit can be done because things are moving far from the equilibrium norm. So the issue is, can people, you know, do you want to push the system in the direction of more equality, more democracy, or do you want to see another system emerge which is worse than the one that we've got? Those are the choices, according to Wallerstein, that we're going to face for about the next 50 years. In other words, congratulations, your lifespan. So you are living, you have the misfortune of what the Chinese call living in interesting times. God save us from the misfortune of living in interesting times. When times are boring, people's lives are much more predictable and stable. When times are interesting, you don't know what the hell is going to happen. But you should know that unless you actually begin acting concertedly with other people, you're at the mercy of what is going to happen. If you do begin acting concertedly, then possibilities open up. And so that's my optimistic concluding note. I want to tell you, I really enjoy teaching this class. I look forward to coming to it, and it was great getting to know you guys. My lectures, the other lectures will go up on the internet soon, so you'll be able to have access to them. Your paper is due 1 week from today, and please remember that if you want it back with comments, you must include a stamped self-addressed envelope when you put it in my mailbox on the fifth floor of the philosophy department by midnight 1 week from today. And that's a solid deadline, okay? So 1 minute after midnight, forget it.
Yes. Well, you said I could just put it in private. Because I'm... I don't know. But...